Hello, everybody. My name is Hector, and I'm an alcoholic and a sex symbol. People always laugh when I say I'm a sex symbol. It pisses me off, you know? Even my best friend, Alba, you know, she's one of my, I've known her for 30 years. Once I told her, you know, this girl told me I'm a sex symbol, and she looks at me and says, Hector, you're not a sex symbol. You're a sick symbol, Hector. It's not funny, guys. You know, her husband, Jimmy, is even worse. You know, they, what's Buster Keaton? They collect memorabilia from Buster Keaton, right? And I say, I don't, Buster Keaton, that was before my time, Jimmy. And he says, Hector, the only thing before your time was paradise. Pisses me off. Before I forget, I want to thank Harlan for inviting me to speak after 15 years. I was here 15 years ago. But he says he loves me a lot. He looks different. When I was here 15 years ago, he was tall, thin, good-looking. He looked like a brunette version of Brad Pitt, you know? What happened to him? And then I saw her. Zan, the blonde Kardashian. She ruined this boy, you know? I like to hear laughter. I like to hear laughter because if God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free, laughter is the energy of God already in the room. You see, we are trudging the road. Thank you. We're trudging the road of happy destiny. We're not trudging the road of disgusting misery. Okay? And I want to also thank Nancy and Denise. These are very naughty girls, you know. They look so wholesome, you know, especially Nancy. She knits. And this, she and Denise says, Hector, we want to show you the town. Okay. And all of a sudden, they started driving towards the woods. I say, oh, where are you going? Well, we're taking to the woods. I don't think so. And then they took me to see, what's it called? This, the Haystack Rock. And they have a house. She and her boyfriend have a house. It looks at the house from, remember the Psycho? Hitchcock Psycho? And it says, oh, that big rock is full of birds, and we love. In the morning, we sit and watch eagles come and eat all the other birds. This is a spiritual journey, Nancy. And then this says, you want to come inside the house? We have 3 bathrooms. And I remember the scene from Psycho, remember? In the shower. No, thank you. Can you take me back, please? Wow. Anyway, I'm going to tell you my story. Remember, whatever I say from the podium is my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated, and I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt, okay? I was born in Argentina, and we were poor, poor like in Argentina, poor in America, middle class all around the world. I remember once I saw an article about poverty in America. They had this black lady in Harlem sitting on a couch watching TV. She's poor, she has a couch. She's poor, and she has a TV set. And the whole article was about how bad the plumbing was in her apartment. Plumbing? What the hell is plumbing? We don't have no thinking plumbing. We are the federales. So, no, we're poor. We have no running water, no electricity, you know, dirt floors. And my parents were very, very violent. But I didn't know I was an abused child until I came to AA, you know. Here they give you all kinds of diseases, you know. My mother used to chain me to a sewing machine, but it was nothing personal, really, you know. She also chained my kid sister and the dog. She was an equal opportunity chainer. In fact, she didn't like anything. I was not afraid of that. Just sit there, you know, chained to the sewing machine, you count the tile. But she used to say, when I do something mischievous, and say, I'm not going to chase after you. We had to come to sleep. So when I was sound asleep, she would uncover me and beat me up with a shoe or a piece of wood. So I was very afraid of my mom. And sleeping was a dangerous adventure. My father was worse. He would get angry, grab a knife or a gun, and we'll run to the street in the middle of the night because he's going to kill us. So my first dream as a child was not to be president of Argentina, a doctor, or a movie star. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. Hector, what are you going to do when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy. With a dull razor blade. Yeah, I grew up in that atmosphere. And that doesn't have anything to do with my alcoholism. The only reason I'm telling you this is because at the end of my pitch, I'm going to tell you how I healed the relationship with my parents. Because that's what we do in AA, you know. And I always dreamed of coming to America. I seen pictures of you in some American magazines, and I just loved you. I just loved you. And you had bedrooms, and you had bathrooms with toilets, and kitchens with a toaster. Wow, what a magical thing, a toaster, you know. And so when I was 24 years old, I came to America. Oh, by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas, okay? If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration. It's too late. I'm an American citizen now for 40 years. And I remember I landed in Miami, and we had like a 2 hours layover, and I got out of the airport, and I look at the parking lot. All these new American cars. I couldn't believe it. In 1961, in Argentina, only a millionaire had a new American car. So I walked around touching them. Wow. Wow. In this country, everybody's rich. I came to the right place. And I went to New York. This hick boy who never left his town, in a little town in Argentina, landed in New York, the tallest city in the world. And I remember my first night there, and I couldn't believe it. You look up and you see these mountains of glass and steel made by man. And I said, wow, this is magical, you know. And I still love America. I'm still in love with America. You know, this is paradise on earth. You know, and I've been to 20 countries, and you know what? When I come here, this is my home. And at the very beginning was very difficult, because when you come here legally, you had to show that you speak English. But my teacher in Argentina was British. Hello, Hector. Oh, no, not really. Enunciate, Hector. 40, 20. Nobody talks like that in New York. I couldn't understand a single word, you know, and it was very difficult. I felt very, very isolated. And I didn't know I had an accent until I had a date with this young lady. We went to see a movie with Gina Rodriguez and Rock Hudson at Radio City Music Hall. And when I'm looking at the movie, I said to her, Gina has a thick accent. And she said, oh, no, it's very charming, just like yours. I have accent? Yes, and it's adorable. I hated the bitch. You know? I never took it out again. That's it. So I went home, I bought a tape recorder, and the next day I listened to myself on the tape recorder. Oh, my God, it was awful. I sounded like Frito Bandido, you know? And from then on, I didn't talk anymore. I just, mm-hmm, uh-huh, yes, no. And I worked really hard. And this is what happens in America. And within a year and a half, I had saved enough money making $95 a week. But you see, I worked a lot of overtime because I don't know anybody. So I worked and worked and saved enough money. And I went to Europe for 4 months. Nobody in 1961 from Argentina, unless your daddy was a millionaire, goes to Europe for 4 months, and I visited 9 countries. And I saw the greatest art of the world. Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Picasso, Van Gogh. I saw all the churches and all the statues. And I remember somebody saying, you know, the most artists competed with each other, but Michelangelo competed with God. Because he's creating his own world, you know. And when I came back, I was changed a little bit because I had lost a hick boy from Argentina, you know. And I went back to the same office because I liked him. It was a design studio. And they said, Hector, you had to socialize because I'm a real isolator, right? If you get to know me, you know I'm a piece of garbage. So I keep everybody, you know, at arm's length. And so I decided to go, in order to socialize in America, I had to go to a bar. You know, I never been to a bar. I was an athlete in Argentina. That's what saved me. You know, I was a basketball player. And that's not funny. So I was short and I couldn't jump high. So I had difficulty. And I said, I'm going to go to a But I had never been to a bar. And, you know, so, and I dressed really very waspy. You see, I had, you know, a three-piece suit from Brooks Brothers. Had a big afro and a big black mustache coming all the way down here. But no matter how I dressed, I always looked like a Mexican yuppie, you know. So I dressed in my three-piece suit from Brooks Brothers, and I rehearsed how to order a drink. Because I'm very anal, I do things properly. So for half an hour, I was in front of the mirror. Excuse me, please. Whiskey, please. Whiskey, please. Could I have a whiskey, please? For half an hour, like a moron. And I walk into this bar. I've never been to a bar. And all of a sudden, a very shishi bar, very elegant. All the guys were tall, blonde, with crew cuts, dark suits, dark ties, 2 or 3 nice-looking ladies. And I thought it was a Mormon bar. You see, because all... You see, the only Americans I knew in Argentina were the Mormon missionaries. They used to come to our little town to try to change us from unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons. And they were very nice people, you know, the Mormons. So I thought it was a Mormon bar. I didn't know they don't drink, you know. So the bartender, this blonde guy, comes over and goes, blah. See, English to us is like Spanish to you. When you don't know it, it's gibberish. But I was prepared. I said, whiskey, please. And he looks at me and goes, blah, again. And I say, whiskey, please. And kept asking me. Now, in hindsight, I realized he was asking what kind of whiskey, on the rocks, with soda. I don't know, caca. So I kept saying, whiskey. He got pissed. He grabbed this funny bottle with a beak and a little glass about this tall. And he poured this piss-like substance inside the little glass and put it in front of me. Why does he give me such a little glass? It was a shot glass. I never seen a shot glass in my entire life. And I looked around. All the Mormons had tall glasses, you know. Well, maybe it's because I'm short. Or maybe he's trying to punish me because, you know, I'm not a Mormon. So I always try to act macho. So I pick up the little glass and I swallow the whole thing in one take. Oh, my God, it was awful. It came out of my ears, my nose, my eyes. I almost died. And this Mormon that was standing next to me, who looked like Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, he says to me, ¿Por qué no prueba Cuba Libre? In Spanish, why don't you try Cuba Libre? Cuba Libre, Cuba Libre, por favor, Cuba Libre. It's easy to pronounce. And it's rum and coke. I loved it. You see, I'm addicted to sugar. And from then on, I drank everything with Coca-Cola. It's Scotch and Coke. Vodka and Coke. And finally, I'd graduated to my drink of choice, sangria and Coke.
Don't go.
Wait until you try it. You don't know. Hello. Wake up. You see, any drink that had an umbrella in it, I just loved. You see, I didn't drink because I liked drinking. I drank because I didn't like myself. I didn't like anything about myself. You know, Leonardo da Vinci said that a perfectly proportioned man is 7 times the size of his head. So I measure my head. Remember, I had an afro. According to that, I'm supposed to be 7 feet 2 inches tall. You see my nose? It looks like a bell pepper, right? Isn't that funny, really? I had a nose job. I'm the only person I know who looks exactly the same, before and after. But when I drank, I was tall, I was good looking, I spoke perfect English, I was a loud asshole, that's what I was. And I got punched a lot and thrown out of places, you know. I felt better when I drank. And I became an alcoholic really, really fast. And I began drinking by myself. The book says on page 57, almost without exception, alcoholics are tortured by loneliness. And you know what's the worst loneliness? It's not when you are by yourself, when you're surrounded by people and you cannot communicate. It's painful, isn't it? So, and I began crawling around my apartment and, you know, and thinking about killing myself. And I couldn't understand it. I had achieved the American dream. I had a nice apartment, furniture from Bloomingdale's, some suits from Brooks Brothers, you know, had a beautiful view of Manhattan. I had achieved the American dream. But you told me when I came here, the reason why I was not happy is because you told me nothing. Nothing that I see with my eyes can fix my insides. Nothing. Not the relationship, not the car, not the money in the bank, not the home or the house. You told me the solution is on page 45 of this wonderful book that we call the Big Book. On page 45. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object, he says in here, its main object is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. The entire book is about God. And I did not know that. And I was depressed all the time. I had a PhD in depression, you know. And I didn't understand why, because I had all the things. And I had my first suicide attempt. Don't ask me why, I don't remember. Maybe the doorman didn't say good morning to me. And I'm very sensitive. I'll teach him a lesson, I'll kill myself. Only in AA people laugh when I say that. You're a bunch of sick people. And the phone rang, and it was my friend Rudy, and Rudy's wife had had, you know, a suicide attempt, so within 3 minutes he realized what happened. He said, Hector, if you don't call me from the hospital in 5 minutes, I call the cops. Click, he hung up. Oh, my God. I want to be dead, but I don't want the cops in my house. How embarrassing is that? So I floated to Bellevue. And they pumped my stomach, and they made me see shrinks, and I kept seeing shrinks and more shrinks, you know. And they were wonderful people, but they couldn't help me because I never told them the truth. And I had a second suicide attempt. I threw myself in front of a bus. And I had a third suicide attempt. And I was always really depressed and unhappy. And one day I came to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was sleeping on the floor in this beautiful apartment I had. I had peeled myself. I was all sweaty. And I sat there and I had a moment of clarity. We all do, don't we? I realized what my problem was. My problem is New York. This is an unfriendly, hostile place. I had to move to a more loving, caring, nurturing place. So I moved to Hollywood. And you know, I remember I took a taxi to the little hotel that I stayed in Hollywood, you know, and I saw this truck with a bumper sticker in the back says, honk again, I'm reloading. So, wow, this is a friendly place, okay? And I forgot to tell you. I forgot to tell you. I got into acting because if I knew all this stuff did not affect me, I'm going to be an actor. And I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III in London better than Laurence Olivier. That's kind of difficult when you can't speak English. And I got into a commercial, two commercials, five commercials. Oh, Hector, any idiot can do commercials. Even Joe Namath does commercials. So God said, okay, little schmuck, I'll show you. And I got into this play, and this play went to Broadway, and we won all the awards on Broadway, including the Tony, which is the equivalent in the theater to the Oscar in movies. And I still felt like a piece of garbage. That's when I decided to go to Hollywood. So I'm in Hollywood. It's the 70s. I'm a Latino guy, you know, and I have this afro, and I have this black mustache coming down to here. And I'm always playing. My first show that I did was All in the Family. The second show was Police Woman, and I tried to rape her. What was her name? Angie Dickinson. I was always killing people, molesting women, smuggling dope. Even one time I was selling babies, you know? And, oh my, I was always handcuffed, always handcuffed, put in jail. I've been handcuffed on TV more times than the Menendez brothers, okay? So finally I get this part. I'm going to play a good guy. It was a sequel to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Woman, remember? Butch Cassidy, was that the name? Yeah, it was a sequel called The Sundance Woman or something with Catherine Ross. You older guys and ladies, remember The Graduate? So I'm going to be in this movie. I'm going to play the good guy. I'm going to save the girl. I'm not going to have sex with the girl, but I'm going to save the girl. Hey, it's progress, not perfection, right? Well, so they give me the part, and then the director calls me home and says, Hector, we forgot to ask you, can you ride a horse? Ha! Can I ride a horse? I'm a gaucho from Argentina. I was born on top of a horse. I lied. So we get to Tucson with all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors. We're going to ride around the jail and save Catherine Ross. So we are going to rehearse. They put me on top of the stupid animal, the horse. This is the horse. This is you. If you know how to ride, you go, tick, 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 tick. Nice. When I did it, it was like this. The director didn't think it was funny. He had a heart attack. Says, Hector, this man on the horse is like one unit. How can you lie to us? He chewed me out in front of everybody. And he made me practice for 4 hours. They wouldn't let me get off the horse. After the 4 hours, I couldn't get off the horse. So they get me off the horse and I cannot get my legs together. And I cannot sit because my ass is a huge blister. So I go to my hotel. I get some sangria and Coca-Cola. And I get pissing drunk. So I come the next day on the set. I said to the director, excuse me, sir. I cannot do this. My ass is a huge blister. Hector, we don't give a shit. You see behind you? It's 200 extras. We cannot hire them tomorrow. And I look behind me, 200 Mexican horses. Oh, my God. If I fall, I'm dead. So they put some wet towels on top. What do you call that thing? The saddle, right? So I'm playing this heavy-duty bandito, right? Bullets across my chest, a hat, the mustache. You know, they give me a gun, and I'm sitting on wet towels. So the six of us are lined up, the principals, in front of the 200 Mexicans, and they give me the gun. I says, Hector, don't cock the gun. And only cock it after galloping and shoot in the air. You know those blanks are very dangerous? Remember many years ago that good-looking guy who killed himself playing Russian roulette? I cannot kill you, but if I get you this close, I blow out your eyes are gone. But I'm an alcoholic. And the wranglers here, each of us six principal have a wrangler holding the what do you call reins. And when they say action, they slap the horses in the ass and we take off. So he's there. I say, I'm going to cock the gun. At least I'll get a shot, right? And I hold it like this. And the horse goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot the wrangler in the ass. He didn't think it was funny. So we're going to do a retake. So now he's holding the horse like this, right? I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. I cocked the gun again, but I put it next to my leg, and the horse goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot my leg. My costume is in flames. I'm an alcoholic. I had to say Catherine Ross. So we start galloping, right, and the flames start coming up and coming up. By the end of the take, it was like a torch on top of the horse. They threw me on the floor. They got some blankets. They rushed me to the hospital. They rushed me into L.A. And I was in the hospital for a whole month because it got infected. So I had two operations, one to remove the infection, one for a skin graft or something. While I was in the hospital, my agent didn't send me flowers. And I'm very sensitive. You don't send me flowers, I'll teach you a lesson. I'll kill myself. I asked my friend Irene, you know, to bring me the pills. You know, I was not into pills, but when I went to Argentina once, I got 500 Valiums, just in case. So I told her to bring me 40. Oh, by the way, I was not into pills. Only once somebody in the gym gave me one of those called Black Beauties. Oh, a lot of junkies here, huh? Oh. He said, Hector, if you take this, you're going to have so much energy. Boy, did I have energy. I cleaned my whole apartment twice. You know, I dusted the ceilings. I couldn't stop. Never again. Give me sangria and coke or give me death. So Irene brought the pills. I took them. And that was my last suicide attempt at my bottom. I was in coma for 3 days in intensive care unit. While I was in coma, I had two cardiac arrests, and they had to revive me twice. Basically, I was dead for 3 days. I had been dead for 3 days, and I had everything. I had a brand new Mercedes, the most beautiful clothes you've ever seen, a wonderful apartment, had enough money in the bank to live for a year without working. One thing was missing. I didn't have Hector. I didn't have Hector. And after 9 months, I was doing the same thing. I was drinking, getting drunk. And my shrink says, Hector, I think you're an alcoholic. I think you should go to AA. Are you sure, Mike? Yes. Yes. Go to AA. And I went to a meeting, you know, and it was dark and seedy. And I said, oh, I don't belong here. Kaka, kaka, kaka. I have three-piece suit. I have a Mercedes, you know. And I said, he's going to forget. And 2 weeks later, Hector, did you go to an AA meeting? I said, no. I said, I went. It's dark. It's serious. Kaka, kaka. He says, there are 1,700 meetings in Los Angeles. Find another one. And I did. And I walked into this meeting. It was well lit. Somebody was playing the piano. I said, oh, this looks like a musical comedy. I belong. And that's May 8, 1979, and I've been sober ever since. That's that's my sobriety date, and if you're class of 79, talk to me after the meeting because I have a party, class reunion in my house. About 15 or 20 of us get together and celebrate. We have a meeting. We take pictures. I've been doing it for 14 years, so if you're class of 79, talk to me. I love AA. I love AA. See, what I found in AA, what you gave me is Hector. I didn't know who Hector was. You see, it always says a spiritual journey. The journey is from the Hector I created based on fear, who lacks everything, to the Hector that God created based on love, who which is wholesome, whole, and has everything in his nothing because everything is inside of him. And that's the journey, okay? But I do the same things that I did 34 years ago when I came to AA. I go to meetings, I have a sponsor, I sponsor people, I pray and meditate. And right now I'm taking seven guys and one girl, and through the book. I love going through the book. I have some spiritual studies, you know, and about 12 years of spiritual studies. And I have 100 books in my house. All the wisdom in those 100 books is in the first 164 pages of this book. Bill Wilson was chosen. He was illumined. He was illumined. You know, he was a special messenger that God chose him. You know, with Time Magazine selected the most influential people of the 20th century, one of them was Bill Wilson, okay? One of the great, great men of the 20th century. Think about it. He had only 3 years when he wrote the book. Think about the people you sponsor. Can they write a paragraph? 3 years sobriety. Anyway, I'm going to talk now about this is what it is like now, you know. And at the beginning, I had problem with God when I came here because, I come from a Catholic background. And my God looked like Charlton Heston, and he behaved like Leona Hemsley. He did not like the little people, you know. And I had to find somebody that I could relate to. And I read a great deal of spiritual literature. And there's a guy called Joel Goldsmith, and he wrote, and this applies only to me, not to you, because he said, regardless of how high my concept of God is, it is wrong, because still a concept. Eventually I have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness, conscious contact, okay? The consciousness that God is, and then leave the subject alone, because with the mind, I'm never going to understand what God is. And the big book says the same thing on page 46. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which we call God. And on page 53 says, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? How can I understand a spiritual entity that takes care of 7 billion people at the same time, when theologians and great spiritual leaders have not been able to define God? We talk about the qualities of God, a loving God, a punishing God, an omnipresent God, but nobody has said God is this. And the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that one sentence, God as you understood him. Think about it. Because the people from Akron, Ohio, they wanted a Christian God in the book. And the people in New York didn't want God at all in the big book. And this idiot, a newcomer, told, Bill Wilson says, so they were going crazy. He said, why don't you say, God as you understand him? And that's it. You see, that's it. Ours is a loving God. It's a loving God. And this is a spiritual program, not a religious program. Religion was written by man. And it separates. I'm a Catholic, you're Jewish, I'm a Krishna, you're a Muslim, I am a Mormon, you're something else. It separates us. But spirituality is based on my spirit. And I learned here that all spirituals are equal. There's no black spirit or white spirit, gay spirit or straight spirit. No female spirit. Not male spirit, not fat spirit or skinny spirit. There's just spirit. And this is a communion of our spirits. And if we share from here, we'll reach you there. That's what we call it, a spiritual journey. And remember what I told you, nothing that I see with my eyes can fix my insides. The solution is in here. And if you're new here, I'm going to tell you something you're not going to understand. I don't care. Everything you came here looking for, you came with it inside of you. Love is inside of you. Prosperity is inside of you. Kindness is inside of you. Sobriety is inside of you. God gave you that. It's inside of you. And the whole purpose of the 12 steps is that journey, to get in touch with the divinity which is inside of us. Because the book says God is deep down inside of us. See? And what is the problem that I have? I'm blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. What are my blockages? My character defects. Okay? The first step says I have a problem, powerlessness. The second step says the solution to that is the power of God. God as you understand him. The third step says, I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What is my will? I did not know, but Joe and Charlie two or three times, and I heard some of my other teachers, and now I know. My thoughts are my will. My will is my thoughts. Somebody said, as a man thinketh in his mind, so is he. Okay? And the book agrees with that. Page 23. The main problem with the alcoholic centered in his mind rather than his body. You see, everything emanates from here. Whatever is in here, it will be out there. Right? And what is my life? I did not know. You told me the sum total of my actions is my life. And Emerson says something very profound. He says, your actions speak so loud, I can hear what you're saying. That's why the book says action, action, and more action. The book also says faith without works is dead. I can sound like Mother Teresa from the podium, but if I don't have my three commitments every week, my program is worth nothing. You see, knowing the book, knowing the spiritual truth, doesn't mean anything. I have to have a consciousness, an awareness that I'm connected to the source. That whatever I am, this God is inside of me. This is a very good God we have in AA. It's portable. Wherever you go, there he is inside of you. You know. And then the book says, I'm blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. And what is my blockage? Is my character defect. So I had to do 4 and 5. 4 and 5 is a relationship with myself. Then I had to go home and do 6 and 7. You know, and say, it takes me 4 months to take somebody through the book. I'm doing it now in 5 minutes. And 7, you know, what I had to do is we do a list of all our character defects, and then we write another column with the opposite. Right? If I'm hateful, I had to be more loving. If I'm stingy, I had to be giving. Right? If I'm isolated, I had to be around people. If I'm lazy, I had to be active. So when I pray to God to remove my character defects, I have a goal. Please, God, remove this and help me to go towards that. And then comes 8 and 9. 8 and 9 is in my relationship with the universe. All the people that I hurt, when I was, he was so eloquent yesterday. Peter Smith, yes? Yeah, who said, he talked about it so wonderfully. 8 and 9 is my relationship with the people that I hurt. You see, I damaged. And the most important, before I do the amends, what I teach the guys is, don't make any amends without talking to me. And in some cases, not only we discuss how to make the amends, but I make them write it down. So they say the right thing. There was a guy, an engineer, who was a newcomer. Poor engineers are stupid. The very left, they had a very brainy. Say, oh, Hector, would you like to sponsor me? I said, well, let me talk to you for a while. Oh, by the way, I've been already working my program. Really? What do you do? Well, I told my wife that I had sex with her best friend and our bridesmaid. That's not making amends. That's passive-aggressive action. You punished you. And she's very angry with me, and I don't understand why.
No, moron. What you had to do is you do living amends. You don't ever do it again, you know. So anyway, and then comes 10. When I am wrong. Did you notice that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have a chapter about them? The 12 steps are a tool to change me, to change Hector. And I don't change Hector. God could and would if he was sought. And a newcomer once at a meeting said the following thing. It pissed me off because it was so profound. He said, surrendering to God is not admitting defeat. It's joining the winning side. Is that good? So the book says the spiritual way of life is not a theory. We had to live it. How do we live the spiritual way of life? It's a constant desire to seek, you know, God in everything and everybody. Instead of, you know, and we practice it by doing prayer and meditation. And after 10 come prayer and meditation. My friend Harvey, who's from England, hello, Hector. And he says, prayer is when we talk to God. When you hear the voice of God talking back to you, it's called schizophrenia. Prayer, the book says pray only for God's will and the power to carry that out. Why is that only? Because I don't know what God's will for me was. I thought being on television, being on Broadway, going to the Oscars, I became a member of the Oscars. I've been to the Oscars many times, and I got all that, and I ended up there for 3 days in intensive care unit. So obviously, I don't know what's good for me. Pray only for God's will to carry that out. You know, first, prayer is a dialogue with God. And prayer doesn't do anything to the mind of God. It does something to the mind of the God, of the person praying. The quality of God doesn't alter. It's always love. See, whether we break spiritual law, whether we behave or don't behave, God loves us. Why he loves us? Because the book says he is the Father, we are his children. We were created by him. It's like when you had a little baby or something, he did something mischievous. You say, don't do that. But you still loved your baby, right? And that's the same thing with God. You know, so we pray to God to hear the still small voice of God which is inside of all of us. And then we go into meditation. Meditation. And people come to me, you know, and says, oh, Hector, I don't mind having problems. I'm always angry. I'm always in a rush. I say, how long do you pray and meditate? Well, I don't have the time. You don't, really. How much television do you watch? Oh, about 2 hours. What do you watch? Well, I watch Jay Leno and American Idol. Oh, good, Jay Leno. So when you have a problem, call Jay Leno. You have time for 2 hours of television. You don't have 5 minutes for God in the morning. And I was reading this book the other day. And it says, you know, you don't have to pray for 5 hours. Just throughout the day. Just make conscious contact. When I get up in the morning, before I put my foot on the floor, thank you, God, for this day. I open my eyes and I can see. I stand on my 2 feet and I can walk. And I have a nice house. And I'm sober. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Plato, before Jesus, he said, a grateful mind is a great mind that attracts to itself great things. When you live in a state of gratefulness, the universe really, oh, he's a happy guy. Let me give you more things to be happier. You're a miserable guy. Oh, he likes to be miserable. Let's give him a car accident. So that's why your sponsor, newcomers, you know, ask you to write the grateful list. And sometimes I forget. I have a gorgeous life, but sometimes I forget to enjoy it. And I have to go to meetings. And why do we keep going back to meetings over and over for 34 years? Because we have to be reminded of the things we already know. Over and over and over. I forget. And some stupid newcomer says, that's brilliant. Newcomers, by the way, stay with us, okay? Nobody wants you anyway. Newcomers, we love you here. We know who you are. We thank God for sending you here. We are your spiritual family. We're going to be with you for the rest of your life if you choose to. We know who you are. We've been there. This is the spiritual family that you'll have forever. So we're going to put our arms around you. We're going to hug you. We're going to love you. We all need a hug. Why? Because we're all skin hungry. We're all skin hungry. And if you come to thank me when I finish, be aware, I'm going to give you a hug. Okay? Okay, so, and then comes the last step, 12, step 12. You know, we give you a title here, newcomers. It's called Humble Servant, step 12. You see, we are people who do service. Because, you see, you cannot keep it unless you give it away. I think Khalil Gibran said it best. He said, when we die, when we make the transition from the visible world to the invisible world, when we die, he said, the only thing that we take with ourselves is what we have given away. And the most important thing we can give away is the gift of ourselves. That's step 12. You see, and the book says, when everything else fails, it doesn't say go out and buy another cashmere sweater, does it? When everything else fails, go and find somebody to help, to care, to love, to keep an eye on. Why? Because the only love that heals us is the love we give away. And that's the only love we can feel inside of us. Okay? And that's what I do with the steps. And I've done seminars, you know, from Hawaii to Iceland on the steps. I like to do it 3 days and we go through the steps. And I just love the big book. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love the steps. Now I'm going to talk to you about what I did with my parents, remember? I hated my parents. And the book says, you know, resentment is the number one killer. And it doesn't say, except with parents. And, you know, one of the things a friend of mine said from the podium says, if you continue seeking your parents' approval, you shall remain forever a child. A lot of people went, ooh. If you continue to seek your parents' approval, you shall remain forever a child. You don't need your dad or mom anymore. What you need is a good sponsor. And I know everybody has problems with mom. This is what you do. Clancy taught me this. When you go home to your mom, you know, and whatever she says, you say, yes, mom. Yes, mom. Of course, mom. Mom. Yes, mom. Yes, of course. Yes. Then go home and do whatever the hell you want to do. It's that simple. You cannot change your mom. I mean, she changed your diapers for feet's sake. Anyway, so I had to think about my mom, and I did inventory. Yes, my mother chained me a few times, and she beat me a few times. But that was only about 20% of the equation. We were poor, poor like in Argentina. And she worked from 5 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. And my daddy had another job, and still we were poor. And I remember when I was 5 years old, we didn't have money for a Christmas tree. And she was very handy with her hands. So she took a broomstick, she took some wire, she made a Christmas tree. 4 branches, 5 branches, 6 branches. Some green paper, she made a Christmas tree. She went out with, I think, a dollar and bought 4 Christmas balls and a pointer. But I had my Christmas tree. And every year got a little bit bigger because she made more things. When I was 12 years old, it is a fashion in Argentina that the boys should get a bicycle. Remember, we were very, very poor. Very poor. But she worked at 2 jobs every single day. No vacations, no days off. And when Christmas Day came and I got up, there was the most beautiful bicycle you ever seen, imported from Italy. It was metallic green. And I had the best bicycle in the entire neighborhood, better than the rich kids. So you see, I realized, after writing a great deal about it, she did the best she could with the tools she had. And the parents she had, my grandparents in Italy, you know, they were not that loving. She had to kiss the hand of her father before going to sleep. See, my parents, and probably your parents, didn't get a set of spiritual tools like we get here. They didn't get sponsored. Remember, they were both illiterate. They never went to school. Both of them died without knowing how to write. You know, but they were doing the best they could with the tools they had. Most of us didn't get it at home, but at least we had the opportunity to go to school and the teachers taught us something. They didn't have that. So I sent her a ticket. She had never been on a plane in her entire life, and she landed in L.A. When she walked into my apartment, she had a 12-feet-tall Christmas tree, real pine, decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And she had 33 presents underneath the Christmas tree. 33 presents. We overdo things in A.A. And I told my mom how much I loved her. And I thanked her for sending me to school, for making my clothes, for buying me clothes for the gym. And never, ever I mentioned what she did wrong. We don't do that in AA. We take care of this side of the street. And she left, and I brought her back 3 years later with my sister Olga. You know, and we had a ball. The first trip and the second trip, we made the most beautiful Christmas trees you've seen in your entire life that looked like right out of a magazine. And I overheard this conversation between my sister Olga and my mom. And my mom says to Olga, "Olga, do you know what I wish for all the mothers in the world?" And Olga said, "What?" "That all of them could have a son like my Hector." And that relationship was healed. When she passed away, she was 91. My heart was at peace. I worked the steps. With my father, it was a little more difficult. He had moved, and I hadn't heard from, I don't know, 14 years or something. And all of a sudden, when I was 14 years sober, I got a letter. He moved to Syria. He's living in Syria. And he sent the letter. I said, "Hi, son, how are you?" And the letter says, "Oh, you know, I wanted to write to you because I need some money to pay some taxes. So can you send me some money to pay my taxes?" After 14 years, you write me this piece of shit because you need money? And the letter continued. "One more thing. My family here says if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. And if I did, I apologize." Oh, did you do something wrong? And I began writing back, listing everything he did wrong. And now I have 4 pages, right? And I can't stop. And newcomers, I did something that you should never do. I asked an old timer what to do. And she said, Hector, would you rather be at peace or would you rather be right?" "I'd rather be right." I waited 50 years for this shit. But you know, newcomers, they brainwash you here, so I sent the letter. I didn't send the money. that didn't feel good. So I went back to the shrink who sent me here 34 years ago. He says, Hector, you had to go to Syria and see your father. You don't know your father. Are you crazy, Mike? Syria is full of Syrians. They all look like my father. I don't want to go to Syria. But you know, newcomers, they brainwash you here. So I called on the phone. He didn't have a phone. So they had to bring him out the phone, called, and I talked to them. And he sounded very senile on the phone. And he was crying on the phone. I said, Dad, I'll be there in a month. And I landed in Damascus, Syria. And this huge man that used to beat me up, that was so afraid of, is about this tall. This old man, bald-headed, with only few white hairs on the side, with his funny, baggy pants running towards me. And he comes over and starts kissing me all over. And he's sobbing. And I'm sobbing. Why am I sobbing? I don't know this old guy. People watching us are sobbing. And then he takes me by the hand like I'm a five-year-old, put me in a taxi and take me to this village, this very, very, very poor village. And he tells me his story. I was there for a week. You see, his father was about 15, 16 years old. His mom was about 14 years old. They had him. They never went to school. He never went to school. He grew up like a little animal in this village. How is he going to know how to be a good, loving, caring father? He had no idea. But he loved me. He really loved me. I just did not love him. I don't want an illiterate peasant from Syria. I want Bill Gates, you know, money, property, and prestige. No, no, Hector, God said, this is your daddy. That's the one you have to love. And he loved me so much, he made me dress in a three-piece suit. This village he lived is so poor, so poor. His house is the only one that has a toilet, okay? And he made me dress in a three-piece suit, sat me in front of the dining room table, a little poor table, and he makes me eat the steak. And then he invites all the villagers from the village to come and say hello to my son Hector from America. And they all have to shake my hand. And then a beggar, smelly, blind beggar without shoes, walk into the room. And he guided his hand to touch my face so that he too may know what his son looked like. That's how much he loved me. But I did not love him. And I spent the week with him, and I talked to him, and I taped him, and I photographed him. And I understood. The little guy did the best he could with the tools he had. I mean, love is like any other subject. Unless somebody grabs you and loves you and touches you and kisses you, you don't know how to do it with somebody else. He didn't know, you know. But he was what he was. When I left at the airport, we were both sobbing. Because I knew I was not coming back. And I said, Daddy, I love you very, very much. And I'm so proud that you're my daddy. And he grabbed my face and kissed me all over. He says, no, 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 son. I'm more proud of you. I'm so proud what you've done with your life, what you achieved. And this visit to my little village, it's the most beautiful gift in the entire world. Nothing, nothing could make me happier. Now I can die in peace. And we hugged and hugged, and I left. And I came back to my country, America. And when I was here, you know, something very subtle changed in me. I always looked like a man. I accomplished like a man. I dressed like a man. I sounded like a man. But inside myself, I was a 12-year-old child, emotionally.
Why? Because being like a man was being like my father, and I hated my father. And he passed away. Now when I think of my father, I smile. He did the best he could with the tools he had. And now I now know what a real man is, a real woman. A real man has nothing to do with what you drive, how much money you have in the bank, or any. Those are wonderful things, by the way. But I'm not talking. But I'm a real, because those things give you physical comfort, but it doesn't heal the hole we have inside. A real man is somebody who is at peace with himself. Because unless you're at peace with yourself, all those things are not going to bring peace. You know, that's why the prayers in Francis prayer under 12 and 12 says, God, make me a channel of thy peace. That's the first spiritual condition you had to have, peace. And then it continues that where there's darkness, I may bring light, and when there's hate, I may bring love. But the first thing he says, make me a channel of thy peace. And that's what I am. Just a channel through which God can shine. Somebody told me the other day, we are the faucet, not the water. I'm just a channel. And I also learned here, because you taught me, that God doesn't do anything to me or for me. He does it through me. That's how we work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we can become, like the prayer says, an instrument through which God can shine. And do what the big book says, to be of maximum use to God and those about us. I'm going to finish now. I love AA. I love AA. This is not my life, AA, but it's my way of life. Somebody said from the point, you're going to repeat it and sit down. He said, I came to AA to stop drinking. And you wonderful people taught me how to live. God bless you, and I love you.